Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And two of the most fabulous and unfabulous summer staples, The tomato and weeds.
Right.
We've got them covered today.
I've got both.
Yeah. Barbara Pleasant's joining us. She's recently written a little article for Fine Gardening called Get the Weeds Out, sort of six things really to keep in mind when you're trying to control weeds in the garden.
Yeah, she's been around for quite a while in the gardening circle. She's written a lot of books on many organic things. Knows a lot about the subject. She's fun to talk to, and there's more to weeding than you might believe.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And we're going to have Dr. Dave Rhodes on the show as well to talk about, in a little more detail, some of the most common tomato diseases that are out there. We've had a particularly rainy season, which means many tomato diseases are going to be a little bit more present in the garden. Dr. Rhodes is a plant physiologist from Purdue University and has long worked in sort of, you know, botany and plant physiology in his career. So we'll get some of the details, you know, what's really going on in his tomato plant. And then when a disease strikes, you know, how does it impact it? So
tomatoes are the great common denominator among gardeners.
So, yeah.
The one plant that everybody likes to brag about and have the first one to give the neighbors.
Or just everybody plants, you know.
Right.
If you don't have anything, you have a tomato.
Watches them wilt away.
That's right. All right, so that's coming up on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stay with us. What's going on in your garden, Bob?
I'm thinking delphiniums again.
Are you really?
I know it's impossible to grow them here, but I was at a nursery the other day.
93 and humid, and you're thinking delphinium?
These incredible blue plants. Uh-huh. Blue's my favorite color. Baby blue, pale blue, bright blue. I'm going to try them again. I went online and read from a lot of people, and apparently, you know, there's some hope, if you give them morning light, afternoon shade, good mulch, and go out and talk to them three times a day. But I know you're shaking your head. And they don't come back the next year, and they die here.
Well,
yada,
that's
yada,
okay.
Yada. But they're gorgeous plants.
It doesn't matter if they don't come back, but it's just once it gets hot and humid.
I am not going to be negative about it. I am going to grow these delphiniums, and I'm going to be a success.
Will you plant some larkspur in the middle somewhere here and there so that when your delphinium poop out, you'll at least have the little larkspur to enjoy?
Delphiniums or die.
Okay. Well, Godspeed, Bob.
What's up in Wishy Estate?
We'll hope that we have a cool spring and early
I
summer next year for your delphiniums.
I'm going to grow delphiniums.
Yeah, you're not going to do it now, though, right? You're going to wait till next spring.
I'm going to buy some perennials I saw just to have that blue out my window, kitchen window.
Okay.
Old disbeliever.
Well, no, there's nothing that says you can't enjoy them for a week or two.
Okay. What can I believe about the Wishy Estate? What's going on out there?
I got a good tip from a gardener.
I don't believe it.
So, and it relates to tomatoes. And, you know, what are the questions we get all the time? How do you keep the chipmunks out? How do you keep the squirrels out? How do you keep the birds away? How do you keep the rabbits away? And he said he bought some red pepper flakes, that you know, would put on your pizza. You know, those big flakes.
Papa John's delivers them.
And, you know, you can buy some big containers of those pretty reasonably. He bought hot pepper flakes, sprinkled them around the tomatoes and some of his other garden plants, and has totally taken care of the pest pressure, the four-legged pest pressure.
Wow.
So, seems like a pretty reasonable way to approach it, I would say. Anything with a good sniffer. Red pepper flakes. And, you know, I would think, too, Bob, the viability of the red pepper flakes would be longer than like using hot pepper wax or something like that, maybe, because you want that residual. You know, if it rains, the pepper flakes are going to hold up relatively well, I would think. So give it a try, folks, if you're looking for an organic four-legged pest deterrent, hot pepper flakes.
You want to eat a peppery gopher.
There you go.
You get the combination.
Something like that. All right. So, yeah, that's what's going on as I watch the tomato diseases spread through my tomato patch.
Okay.
But we'll get to that in a little bit. I did want to mention one thing, Bob. We got a press release from the Kentucky Department of Agriculture. The state quarantines 20 counties to contain the emerald ash borer. The quarantine prohibits, quote unquote, regulated articles from being moved outside of a quarantine area without a certificate or a limit permit. So basically, the quarantine areas include the seven counties where the emerald ash borer has been positively identified, and then the counties that are in the vicinity, obviously, right? So that includes Boone, Bourbon, Campbell, Carroll, Fayette, Franklin, Gallatin, Grant, Harrison, Henry, Jefferson, Jessamine, Kenton, Oldham, Owen, Pendleton, Scott, Shelby, Trimble, and Woodford.
Bummer.
We've got a lot of counties in the state
of
Kentucky.
Bummer, bummer, bummer.
Yeah. So basically, you cannot move. The regulated articles are defined as the emerald ash borer, so don't be moving any borers. Hardwood firewood of any tree species.
Right.
Ash nursery stock. Green ash timber. Other ash material and any other materials that present a threat of artificial spread of the emerald ash borer. So you can't move these across county lines. You know, there's some detail to it. So like if it's covered or in a contained truck and you have a permit and, you know, you'd be in the industry and you would know all of those rules. But basically for the average person, Bob, this means do not move firewood.
I bet
any firewood.
It'll be all 120 counties before we're done here.
Yeah, it probably will be. So take it seriously because, you know.
It is.
It is serious. So there you go. And of course, you can go to the Kentucky Department of Agriculture's website or our website at WFPL.org for more information. All right.
Weeds can be as difficult to deal with as the ash borer, I'm thinking.
Yeah, even more so, at least at present.
And we've got the person to deal with us. She's Barbara Pleasant. She's a gardener, garden blogger, and author who has written organically-based books for Story Press on composting, growing houseplants well, using stone, and the fine art of weeding. She's with us today from her home in Floyd, Virginia, to talk about weeding, which can be more scientific and elegant than most gardeners imagine. Barbara, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You have a great and varied career in the gardening world. Tell us a little bit about your background. What got you into this stuff?
Well, I tell you, I had a career that I couldn't stay with much longer. I was a child welfare worker, and it was so rough that I think, like a lot of people, I found refuge in my vegetable garden and wrote an article on growing spinach, and Organic Gardening magazine paid me money.
Wow.
And I said, well, maybe I can do more of this. And so it's taken about 25 years to get here. So
an overnight success.
Oh, of course. No, it took about 10, 12 years to build it into a full-time job.
Yeah.
Good.
So you spend a lot of your time writing for different people.
Oh, I have written for many, many people over the years,
okay.
And it's constantly changing.
Yeah.
Right now, I do mostly books, and I work for Mother Earth News magazine.
All right, great.
Most of them for story publications, right? Your books.
Yes, they are.
Great.
Wonderful
great.
Garden publisher.
Yeah, great publisher and a great magazine, so you're in good company.
Yeah. In your prelude to your article about weeds in the June Fine Gardener, you mentioned about weeds being sort of a necessary evil in the garden, at least as far as the weeds are concerned. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, most weeds fall into this broad category of pioneer plants. They're able to move in into a wasteland and have special talents for adaptation. Of course, once you've been gardening for any length of time, your weeds change, and sometimes cultivated plants become weeds.
Right.
So, you know, whether or not we're talking about curly dock, which is a terrible weed in my garden, or, you know, I pull up as many tomatoes as curly dock, to be honest.
Yeah, I've noticed that in the last couple of years myself.
But the tomatoes come up real easy, and so to me that's really the difference between a weed and a knotweed.
Right.
Something that's a problem and you can't hardly get it out, that's a weed.
That's the problem. So they're opportunistic to a certain degree. Weeds typically sprout out up in bare ground or newly cultivated ground is sort of the first rule
of order. Yeah, they're the pioneers. They're going to be the first ones that move in.
So what can we do to, you know, offset some of this, the weed problems? How are we contributing to part of the problem?
Well, if you leave soil open and bare, then the natural solution, nature's solution, is to use weeds to get it green again. You know, the world wants to be green, especially where we live.
Right.
So if you beat them at their own game by keeping the soil full of plants and the areas that aren't planted with anything, keep them mulched so that the sun can't reach the surface, and then weeds tend to be very spindly if they manage to make it at all.
Well, yeah, Barbara, in fact, your article mentioned six consecutive steps. Let's take them one at a time. Step number one from Barbara Pleasant is let sleeping weeds lie.
This is the hardest one. is to not cultivate unless you really have to, and don't dig open spaces unless you really have to. And if you don't dig up the soil, chances are you're not going to see weeds because they're all distributed in the top few inches, the ones that are any good.
Mm-hmm.
So the less, you know, cultivating you do unnecessarily, the fewer weeds you're going to have. Like in midsummer, for example, you get control of them, and then the top of the soil stays dry if it's not mulched. And that is kind of a mulch, that top dry inch of soil.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But, you know, not having conditions for germination, that's the key.
Okay.
Well, how long will weeds live in the soil, do you think?
It varies with species. Some have been clocked at 30 years.
I've wow. read that. Like clover seed
but,
can...
But in general, you know, you hear the old saying, 1 year's weed is 7 years seed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, most of them are really going to be not in good condition after 3 to 4 years. And after seven, there won't be a whole lot. One of the things we tend to not understand is that there are a lot of predators out there that eat weed seeds. You know how in late summer in the evening you hear crickets
sure.
all over the place?
Uh-huh.
Guess what they eat?
It's weed huh. seed.
Weed seed.
I didn't know that.
Carabid beetles eat weed seed. So a lot of the little creatures that run around in that secret world of uh-huh. the mulch and under plants where we don't go, they do eat weed seeds. So many of them will disappear.
They yeah. sing for their supper.
Okay, so we want to minimize the amount of bare ground that's there. We
right.
want to let sleeping weeds lie.
And then I think the next one follows. You mulch whenever you do have bare ground.
Mm-hmm.
I know that slugs are an issue. So whenever I say mulch, I hope most gardeners understand, mulch unless you have a runaway slug problem. Because that's really the only drawback to mulching. Is have you had a wet year like we have?
Yes, we have indeed.
It's been awful.
Yeah, well, it's finally stopped raining, thank goodness, and so I've got a chance against the slugs.
Well,
but you know, it's unusual to be this late, you know, midsummer uh-huh. to really do heavy mulching, but because of heavy rains and
yeah.
all that thing, I couldn't. Had to weed instead.
Well, Barbara, are there different mulches that are more or less slug friendly?
No.
Okay. like pine straw is not going to be a little tougher for them to maneuver about than a barky sort of mulch or a hardwood mulch.
The unfortunate thing is my experience is with some mulches, they'll host the little bitty slugs,
uh-huh.
which drive me crazy.
Oh.
And one big slug can do as much damage as many little bitty slugs.
Uh-huh.
And so I think when you switch out mulches, really you just attract a different species of slug in my experience.
Okay.
But the thing is, it's not always a problem. It's not always a problem mm-hmm. with many, many plants.
Right. So mulch, 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 unless you have a runaway slug problem.
Unless you have a runaway slug problem.
Well, how thick do you mulch, mulch, mulch?
You know, that's debatable. People have different opinions.
Right.
I think 3 inches is always a good rule of thumb. But that may be too thick, depending on what kind of mulch you're using.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you have a nice light in terms of sunlight, it's going to block sunlight to the soil. For in terms of weed control, that's what you want the mulch to accomplish.
Right. When's the optimum time to actually weed? When you're ready to not let the sleeping weed lie?
I love weeding after a heavy rain.
Uh-huh.
I think it's actually fun.
Yeah, I do too.
But when it's dry, on the other hand, you can chop at them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're pulling, the soil has to be wet, or otherwise what happens is you pull and the crown breaks off and gets left behind, and 2 weeks later that weed is back bigger and better than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like I'm winning when I weed when they're wet. I mean, I get them out of there and I say, yes, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and
yeah.
is there, Barbara, is there a time to, you know, when hand weeding's adequate, but other weeds, you really should use some sort of efficient, sharp digging tool to get all of the root out?
Well, one of the problems with weeds in a lawn is that if you go digging about, you're going to tear up new places in the turf
mm-hmm.
where new weeds are going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I have a section of lawn where I want it weed free, and I encourage gardeners to really choose one section of the lawn that you want to be really nice.
And then don't worry about
and
the rest.
And let the rest have some Dutch white clover in it and whatever, you know, isn't offensive. But I'll take a narrow knife, like a steak knife,
mm-hmm.
and like get down below a dandelion at a real acute angle and try to get it about 3 inches below the surface and then just pull it out. And so there hasn't been a disturbance really, except a little hole left behind where the dandelion was.
Okay. And after you pull it out, you have a compost pile. Talk about those.
I compost all the weeds in the compost pile. I mean, it is much too... I have way too many weeds to separate who's got seeds and who doesn't. Besides, many weeds hide their seeds.
Oh, yeah.
So you may pull up a plant and not see a lot of flowers on it, not see what looks like seed pods and think, oh, it's not holding seeds. But it really is.
And
for example, a chickweed will continue to set seeds over a two-month period, so it can still be in bloom.
Oh.
And you think, oh, I've got it early. It doesn't have any wheat, any seeds in it. Well, it does.
So you compost your weeds, but there's a rule in terms of composting weeds because they have to cook to a certain degree, do they not, to destroy the viability of them in the future once you use your compost back in
the
garden?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And I find that the compost I make myself at home in my garden from my garden refuse, most of the weeds that I see are vegetables. And they're not bad weeds.
Right.
But every time I've brought in mulch or you know, materials, manures, oh man, that'll bring in some weeds quick.
Oh.
So kind of watching what you bring in is always important. But if I know I've got a lot of weed seeds, and for example, last year I cleaned up an area that had cocklebur in it, and you know what those seeds can be like. They're there forever. And so I'll go ahead and put those in a separate compost pile if I can. And if I can't and I need weed-free compost, then you can put it in a black plastic nursery liner and put it in a plastic bag and stick it in the sun on a summer day.
And cook it.
It'll cook.
Right.
Huh.
So just one day's worth?
I would leave that out for 2 or 3 days because of it may not reach the critical temperature in one day, but in a couple of days it will.
But then you wouldn't want it too much longer than a couple of days because then it
methods that people use that involve, you know, ovens and such, you run a risk because you can't let it get above 170.
Okay.
So
there is a balance in
there. Yeah, there's a balance. Of course, one solution is when you're digging a planting hole. You use any weedy compost at the bottom of the planting hole. And so it's separated from the forces that want to bring the weeds to life by several inches of soil.
And then step 4 in the Barbara Pleasant weed control business is off with their heads.
Oh, that's so much fun, isn't it?
Talk about that.
I had one garden that had red root pigweed.
And
after a while, you know, it gets so tough that the best thing to do is go through with pruning loppers and just chunk it off. And, oh, that always felt so good.
And you get rid of the seeds that way, too, before they go to seed.
You do get rid of the seeds. I know that a couple of weeks ago I had a really weedy area, and I couldn't find any tool and ended up just chopping through there with a hoe.
Wow.
Just to take it all down, from shedding seeds.
Exactly.
You go, girl.
You got to make these choices quick, right?
I got up early in the morning. I mean, I was determined.
All right. Mind the gaps between the plants. Another weed control measure.
Oh yeah, I've got a perennial bed, and that is the most efficient strategy to use in that perennial bed is to keep things as close together as they can go without it turning into an overgrown jungle. And I don't have to weed. I mean, I would think in a growing season, I maybe spend 2 hours weeding this bed. I spend more time thinning plants.
Right.
Yeah, I mentioned that last week, that mine is at that stage. It took about 3 years where there's almost no weeds in my big perennial borders now.
Now you have to spend time thinning the plant.
It's a balance, right?
Yeah,
That's right. It's a good problem to have.
Exactly.
But that's something I can do in the spring and the fall and take that summer off and just enjoy it pretty much.
Isn't it great?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, thus far, we haven't had too much of a problem with having to irrigate the garden because it's been such a rainy season. But We all know that that can turn off in any moment, and we can be hit with a droughty year. Are there watering suggestions in terms of how to, you know, care for our plants without nurturing the weeds?
Well, you know how it is in July and August. Mm-hmm. Anything that doesn't get water, if there's a drought situation, doesn't do well. If it grows, it doesn't grow very well.
Right.
And so if you can target your watering by using, I use soaker hoses in the vegetable garden, and if I have new nursery plants that are at risk from drought, you know, they really need water for the first year or two, sometimes I'll dig holes and bury soda bottles or water bottles that have a couple of little holes in them.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that way I can fill those up, and the water goes down into the root zone and it's not up at the surface.
That's
where
a great idea.
Either evaporate or help weeds along.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
It is. Well, thank you. It's been fun.
We really appreciate your time and your very good advice about helping us get the weeds out of the garden.
Well, I hope it means listeners are going to spend a little less time weeding and a little more time enjoying their garden.
There you go.
Exactly.
All right.
Author Barbara Pleasant is an expert on weed removal and control. For more information on Barbara or her website, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we arm ourselves with the facts about the most common tomato diseases. That's after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Tomato Bob Hill here.
And, okay, here's the thing. I know that some problems can move to your tomatoes if you have a really weedy garden. Certain weeds harbor certain insect problems and diseases.
You're looking right at me when you say this.
No,
huh?
I'm just saying.
Okay.
I'm trying really hard to keep, you know, the garden weed-free, but I still have an unusual disease pressure this year, Bob. In my tomato patch.
Actually, we do too.
Yeah. And I think maybe we can blame it on the weather.
It can't be us.
Well, we'll
we're experts.
No, yeah. Well, actually, we found a real expert. We'll find out who we can indeed blame it on. Dr. Dave Rhodes is joining us. He heralds from Yorkshire, England, where he received a degree in botany and a PhD in plant physiology from Manchester University. He was a postdoctoral associate at the School of Biological Sciences at the University of East Anglia. And then he came to the United States to do work for the DOE Plant Research Laboratory at Michigan State University, then to a bio company in California, and now he, since 1985, has been on faculty at Purdue University in the Department of Horticulture and Landscape Architecture. His research interests are in plant metabolism, including nitrogen assimilation, plant resistance to environmental stress, and computer modeling of plant metabolism, and he also teaches an undergraduate course on vegetable crop production. Thus, we have sought him out to describe the life of a stressed tomato. Dr.
Right.
Rhodes, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Janine.
Certainly.
And Bob.
In a perfect world, a happy, healthy tomato lives in a garden that can be described as what? Before we get into all the diseases, what's the perfect scenario?
Probably sunny, warm.
Mm-hmm.
Well watered, but not waterlogged. Well fertilized, disease free, weed free, and colonized by beneficial insects that can keep insect pest populations at a low level.
Mm-hmm. So, in terms of well fertilized and, you know, mulched and that sort of thing, have you found that synthetic fertilizers or organic fertilizers or, you know, just really improving the nutrients in the soil using compost, et cetera, is one better than the other?
I think all plants respond quite well to synthetic fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
But tomatoes in particular need a high level of potassium.
Mm-hmm.
And so potassium nitrate is often a good source for supplying both the potassium and the nitrogen that tomatoes need. Over-fertilization with ammonium fertilizers can cause some problems of pH, soil pH, and blossom end rot. So for conventional growers, potassium nitrate as a source of nitrogen is good. But for organic growers, building up the soil tilth with compost is an excellent way of providing many of the nutrients that mm-hmm. all plants need.
All right.
Well, Dave, can you give us sort of a life in the day of a tomato? What's going on in the plant as it grows, and the flowers, the fruit, and it ripens? Kind of walk us through the whole season of it.
Okay. The seed will be planted at a shallow depth, maybe a quarter of an inch. Tomato seed is quite small, and so it has very few reserves. And if you plant too deep, it's not going to emerge properly. So initially the seed will germinate and a root would form, and then the shoot with cotyledons, and then the cotyledons would eventually give way to true leaves, which will then start photosynthesizing. By photosynthesizing, I mean that the leaves will be taking up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through small pores called stomates, and they'll be taking up this carbon dioxide in exchange for water. They will be converting that carbon dioxide into sugars, mm-hmm. And then sugars will be transported around the plant from the leaf to the roots, eventually to the flowers, and developing fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the root is growing and taking up water required to sustain photosynthesis, and also taking up nutrients from the soil, nitrate, potassium, calcium. The nitrate taken up by the roots can be assimilated into amino acids, which can then be transported around the plant and converted into proteins. The water and nutrients are essential for plant growth, and anything that disrupts these processes will cause growth inhibition.
Mm-hmm. Well, to that end, like, you know, I think I've read or seen where the flowers will drop off in too much heat, or what can affect the flowers?
Water deficit stress will cause a buildup of a hormone called abscisic acid, which can cause flower drop.
Mm-hmm.
The abscisic acid is a hormone that responds to drought stress, and it tells the plant to close stomates, prevent water loss, but that also inhibits photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm.
It prevents carbon dioxide from being taken up, so there's a trade-off. So eventually, if those water deficits are prolonged, the plant will begin to wilt, growth will cease, and you might get abortion of flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be exacerbated or made worse by heat stress.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so they're pretty smart.
So, I mean, that's why it's important to know that entire sort of life cycle and all those physiological actions that are taking place in the plant for it, you know, when it's doing well, because when any of those functions are disrupted, it causes somewhat of a ripple effect.
It does indeed.
So Dave, let's talk about some of those disruptions.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to tomato diseases, we've had a very rainy season here in Kentuckiana,
mm-hmm.
As you guys probably have up there in West Lafayette,
yeah.
As well. So people are starting to see leaf curl and wilt and various types of indications that there's some sort of disease pathogen present, something's going wrong. So can we talk about the more common problems that people may be seeing in their tomatoes?
Yes. At the seedling stage, if you have water logging, you can run into problems of a disease called damping off, which will essentially cause wilting and a death of the plants at the seedling stage. This is caused by various fungi called Pythium and Rhizoctonia species.
Mm-hmm.
Other diseases that can cause wilting in tomatoes include Verticillium and Fusarium species of fungi. So these cause Verticillium wilt and Fusarium wilt. Many of these diseases can be promoted by excessive moisture, high humidity.
Dave, where does the disease begin? I guess if we're looking at Fusarium wilt or Verticillium wilt, you know, are they just spores floating around waiting for the right opportunity?
Yes. They can persist in the soil for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So there are reserves of Fusarium and Verticillium spores in the soil that can enter the roots and disrupt the xylem tissue, which is the main tissue for transporting water and nutrients around the plant.
So, Dave, it doesn't necessarily have to come into contact with the foliage and spread that way. It can actually be taken in through the roots, so mulch and that sort of thing wouldn't keep the verticillium or the fusarium wilt away, huh?
That's true. Okay. But there are verticillium and fusarium wilt resistant varieties. If you're running into a problem of these diseases, one approach you can take is to try to purchase these resistant varieties, and that will give protection against these two, verticillium and fusarium. Also, you can try crop rotation into different areas of the garden. If you're getting buildup of pathogens in the soil, then don't plant in the same area year after year. Just rotate into different regions of the garden.
Gotcha.
Dave, on the pollination front, we've read a lot lately about the disappearance of the honeybees. Are there enough pollinators around anymore to do the job with the tomato plants?
Tomatoes don't often require any pollinators. It can be self-pollinated.
Ah, how does that work? How do they self-pollinate?
The anthers develop and shed pollen within the flower itself to pollinate the ovary.
So male and female are in the same flower,
yes,
essentially.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
I don't know how I missed that.
All right. So, okay, we gave Bob the little sex education lesson when it comes to tomatoes.
Yeah.
We've talked about, started with some fungal diseases. What are some other fungal diseases that people are going to find on their tomatoes, Dave?
If tomato fruit is allowed to contact the soil, then you're going to get a lot of fruit rots developing.
Okay.
So one approach to avoid those is to prevent the fruit from contacting the soil.
Sure.
And that can be achieved by staking the tomato plants or trellising them or by using mulches. Some growers will use plastic mulch to prevent those diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Some diseases are spread by sprinkler irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
One example would be early blight. Caused by Alternaria species. This fungus will be spread by rainfall or sprinkler irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
So you can maybe avoid spread of this disease by drip irrigation or furrow irrigation rather than using a sprinkler.
Mm-hmm. But with a rainy season like this, we may see an increased incidence of early blight then, huh?
Yes, okay. Yes.
And how does it present itself, early blight? What will we see on the plant?
You'll see initially leaf necrosis, then eventually it will damage the fruit. So many of the diseases will present with specific characteristic lesions on the leaves or on the stems or on the fruit, as some will affect both. There are some good guides available online to try to identify what disease you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
You can often tell by just looking at the leaves or the fruit symptoms to identify the cause.
I believe that I have a touch of early blight myself. Does it help to trim away the infected foliage to slow the progress of the disease?
It can occasionally, but some of these diseases, once they appear, it may be too late.
Okay. So expect
a
gradual
decline. They can
spread
quite rapidly.
Okay.
Fortunately.
Yeah. I had a touch of some viral diseases as well, the tobacco mosaic virus, and I did, in fact, pull those two plants out and disposed of them into a very hot compost pile.
Uh-huh.
So let's talk about some of the viral diseases, because that works a little bit differently, because it gets in the vascular system of the plant, spread a little bit differently, and we need to take them a little bit more seriously, perhaps, too, in terms of getting the plant out of the garden.
Yes, it's always good to remove diseased plants and dispose of disease tissue properly.
Mm-hmm.
If you allow that material to persist in the soil, it will infect your next crop. But tobacco mosaic virus can be spread by injury to the plants.
Uh-huh.
So cultivation injury or pruning can spread the virus. I believe it can be transmitted by smokers.
Oh, yeah? Huh.
Because of it persists in tobacco products.
Huh.
So just a smoker handling a tomato plant
can
cause infection with TMV.
That's interesting. Huh.
Some other viruses that affect tomato include alfalfa mosaic, curly top cucumber mosaic.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these can be transmitted by aphids. They insert their mouth parts into the phloem tissue and can transmit viruses in that way.
Mm-hmm.
These will cause leaf necrosis and abnormal fruit development. One way to control aphids is to maintain a good beneficial insect population, such as lady beetles,
mm-hmm.
which will keep the aphid population under control.
How do you do that? How do you keep lady beetles happy?
Don't spray broad-spectrum broad-spectrum insecticides that will kill all insects can actually cause flares of aphids because you've removed all the beneficial insects.
Oh.
Great.
So just be cautious about what insecticides you apply if you are using that strategy, and try to spray with more selective insecticides.
What would you recommend in insecticides?
It depends on which insect pest you have available. Mm-hmm. If you have some like a tomato hornworm, you might use Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a...
Or just squish them?
Yes,
if
you can find them, they're pretty well camouflaged.
Janine lives to squish them.
Just look for their poop and you can look above and find them pretty easily.
That's true. They have very distinctive feces. Easier to spot than the insects themselves.
Indeed.
Well, Dave, there's a great trend lately in heirloom tomatoes. Are they more or less resistant to some of these diseases than the disease-resistant varieties that have been invented since?
I think, generally speaking, the heirlooms lack some of the resistance genes that are now available in the hybrid and open-pollinated varieties.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of work has gone into developing varieties that carry resistance to Verticillium, Fusarium, tobacco mosaic, and some other diseases. So I think in general, heirlooms lack some of those disease resistance genes.
Well, have you learned that some of these fungal diseases and viral diseases are developing resistance to, you know, any other remedies we might have for them? You know, they outsmart the chemicals, so to speak.
Different strains of Fusarium and Verticillium have been identified, so that it's apparent that some of the Verticillium and Fusarium species are mutating,
mm-hmm.
developing new strains that will be more pathogenic, and then the plant breeders will have to deal with those as they come along.
Mm-hmm.
Some resistance is not available for tomato for some species.
Mm-hmm. So, Dave, then ultimately, are there, you know, you've talked about crop rotation, you talked about,
mm-hmm.
you know, maintaining a good balance of beneficial insects, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of practices should we more fervently adopt, I guess, to try to offset the incidence of some of these diseases?
Well, I would say good practices that would prevent some of these diseases would be good crop rotation,
uh-huh.
not overwatering, avoiding sprinkler irrigation, using staking or trellising to prevent fruit from contacting soil,
uh-huh.
using mulches, avoiding injury to the plant,
okay.
and then purchasing disease-resistant varieties.
Because you know what, this I think a lot of my plants when I first put them out,
mm-hmm.
were injured because it was so windy.
Ah, that's possible.
Yeah, and like they were, you know, I sink them pretty deeply, but you know they were a little bit on the leggy side.
Yeah,
and I think that wind injury over the course of a couple of weeks, because we had such windy conditions, mm-hmm. might have sort of damaged a little bit, you know, at that soil level.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be why I've noticed a little bit more blight. And then, of course, the rainy conditions certainly haven't helped the situation.
Yes, growers in Indiana, especially in the southern part of the state,
uh-huh.
will have problems of injury of transplants from blowing sand.
Huh.
They'll often plant rows of rye between the
to protect them
crops.
Sure,
rows to protect them. Yes,
uh-huh.
It's kind of a running joke in late summer that you hide from your neighbor with tomato plants because he's going to come carrying 5 gallon buckets of these things. Is there a way you can thin out the crop, get in there, and pull out half of them before they, you know, become bigger tomatoes to prune them out and keep the volume down, or even bigger and better, maybe?
Sure, that's more easily done at the seedling stage. Yeah, good plant spacing is probably key to optimum
mm-hmm.
performance of individual plants. If you plant too tightly together,
mm-hmm.
you will not get as good performance from the individual plants.
Mm-hmm. Will that increase disease incidence as well, just because, you know, air circulation and
true.
Light and drying and all that isn't going to be optimum either?
That okay. can have an effect, okay. sure, yes.
You get more fried green tomatoes that uh-huh. way too, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So Dave, what's your take on some of these new, and I don't think they're necessarily that new, it's just we're starting to see them in ads a little bit more, but your take on the upside-down growing technique for tomatoes? Any talk about how successful that is?
I've seen that on TV.
Uh-huh.
I've never tried that technique myself.
Yeah. So, and you haven't heard any yay or nay about it?
No.
Okay.
What's your gut feeling about it? Is it counterintuitive that you can't grow big tomatoes dangling from the bottom of a pot?
It doesn't seem to be any easier to water the plant.
No.
To me, you're lifting the water.
No kidding.
In order to irrigate from the top, presumably.
Uh-huh.
And that would be more difficult, I would think, for some growers. You know, if you're growing them on your patio, mm-hmm. I think it's
right.
easier to water them.
Yeah.
If they're stud vertically in a pot rather than hanging down.
Yeah.
So I would imagine it might cause more problems of of watering, which could then lead to more problems
of,
say, fruit cracking
uh-huh.
and blossom end rot.
Uh-huh. Those fluctuations in dry and wet.
Yes,
huh?
Yeah.
Gotcha, yeah.
Particularly for older growers, it might be very difficult to reach the pot for watering
sure.
properly.
So maybe a little drip irrigation thing set up would be the perfect scenario.
That
huh?
would be, yes, yeah.
Sounds good. All right. Thank you so much for your time and insight into tomato diseases, because I suspect that it's going to be a very diseasey season.
Hopefully not. Hopefully they'll grow out of it.
Yeah, hopefully.
I didn't know diseasey was a word. I love this show.
Oh, I get to make up words all the time. All right. Thanks, Dave.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Dr. Dave Rhodes is a plant physiologist in the Department of Horticulture and Landscape Architecture at Purdue University. He spoke to us from their campus in West Lafayette, Indiana. Of course, for more information on Dr. Rhodes and tomato diseases, please see our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a few diseasey listeners' questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
There ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a big homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love. Homegrown tomatoes.
Well, Miss Wishy, we have two excellent questions this week.
All right.
And they're both for you.
Well, I think you can manage these as well.
Okay. Well, I'll start with you and see how well you
okay,
do.
Okay, you can read them.
We'll grade you.
All right.
Here's the first one. How can I get rid of thistles from my garden?
Thistles are tough. And, you know, the weed interview can suggest some ideas. Grubbing them out for one, but they often have pretty deep root, and they may come back. I would recommend not letting them ever go to flower, right?
No.
To spread the very fluffy seeds that can
right.
travel afar. And because they are deep-rooted, Bob, I found that sometimes tackling those types of weeds with glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, is sometimes not a bad idea. But when you're talking about tougher weeds, you can't just go to the store and buy the little already mixed spray bottle of Roundup.
Yeah.
Go and look for a glyphosate product that has a high active ingredient percentage of glyphosate. You know, it can be any brand name. And open up the little booklet and read the labeled instructions, because they will tell you what the percentage is to mix based on what kind of weed problem you have. So the tougher the weed, the higher, you know, the more concentrate you may have to use in your mixture.
I use it all the time. I use 15 gallons of mix just this past couple of weeks on all these weeds. Mm-hmm. It will work on thistles, but boy, be careful, because all you do is you'll have plants, you just one little squirt in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. I have a 2.5 gallon backpack, and you can wipe out something you really care about pretty quick.
Yeah.
But it'll work.
Yeah, but you just have to follow
stronger
the instructions. Absolutely. In terms of what weed it is and what the percentage.
And wear really good boots and heavy pants, because that spray will get on your body, whether you realize it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be pretty tricky stuff.
Which we should do when we use any sort of chemical in the garden, to be sure.
Absolutely.
All right, another question. This one's from Vicki Meredith, Bob.
Yeah, she has 5 Korean spice viburnums. She had them for 13 years. They've always bloomed profusely in the past, have not bloomed for the last 2 or 3 years. She fertilizes with 10-10-10, no change in sun or shade. What could the problem be?
But not very good bloom anymore.
Yeah. Hmm.
Okay, the usual suspects, right? You have to ask the question, did she or somebody else inadvertently prune at the wrong time?
Exactly.
With these spring flowering shrubs, you want to prune...
right after they're done blooming.
Right after they're finished blooming, exactly.
Yeah, if you prune them back in the fall, you're done.
Right, and of course that'll prune away your berries, so it's kind of tricky for some people. But you have to do it. The fact that they're 13 years old, has she ever done any sort of restorative pruning?
What's the other one?
Pruning back some of the oldest wood will encourage new growth, and that may bloom better for her.
I've done that a lot with big shrubs, and they really come back stronger and happier and healthier than they were before. So that's another factor.
Yeah. One other consideration, and I think a lot of people don't think about this. You know, she said she fertilizes with 10-10-10. If people fertilize their lawns with a high nitrogen, that often is taken up by the shrubs and trees and stuff that are in the lawns as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't think about, oh, I'm fertilizing my lawn, not
They're
my shrubs.
Trees too.
So too much nitrogen, of course, if the shrubs look healthy, too much nitrogen encourages foliar growth at the expense of bloom. So if you heavily fertilize your lawn, you throw off your plants.
Well, she's using 10-10-10, so it may not be the culprit here, but generally you're right about the high nitrogen.
Yeah.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246. Well, Ms. Mushy, once again, this Latin word of the week, I tend to think about tall, and I'd be wrong.
I picked this because I knew we were going to talk about tomato diseases, and I suspect that under a microscope, verticillium wilt probably has some sort of whorled function to it.
H-O-R-L.
Whorls.
Yeah.
The Latin word of the week this week is verticillaris, verticillatis, or verticillata or verticillatum. And those are, you know, terms we've heard with some very
common,
plants,
words,
in fact. But it means having whorls, W-H-O-R-L-S, as Bob said, forming a ring around an axis. So, for example, Adenophora verticillata.
The narrow-leafed ladybells.
And narrow-leafed ladybells, I mean, literally, the way that the leaves are situated around the stem suggests that whorled behavior.
Yeah.
Asclepias verticillata.
The whorled milkweed.
Same thing with the foliage.
I can see that.
The bloom, in fact.
Right.
Coreopsis verticillata.
The whorled tick seed.
Whorled tick seed, same thing with the foliage. Ilex verticillata.
Oh, my favorite.
The winterberry.
The winterberry,
Mintha verticillata.
Mint.
And that's one of the things, one of the qualities of mint, square stem, but also those whorled leaves around the stem.
That's a great example.
Polygonatum verticillatum.
The whorled Solomon seal.
Whorled Solomon seal. And Helianthus verticillatus.
Good old sunflower.
Sunflower. And we know that there's many species of sunflowers based on the interview we did a couple of weeks ago. And Apparently, there's a Helianthus verticillatus. Yes. So, if you see verticillata, verticillatus, or verticillatum, you'll know likely that the leaves are, but it could also be the blooms, are whirled around the stem, forming a ring around an axis.
I gotcha.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Paul Capiello on sedges and a worry-free look at weeds this time around.
Homegrown is produced by the very vertical Brad Yost. In the studios of WFPL, I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.